Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Look, hey, Ross Murray on the podcast. Ross go jamming on the podcast. Ross, what are you up to?
What am I up to? Nothing much. Well, very much boring. Wouldn't say middle-aged, but 35 cliched lifestyle. So married, got a kid now, 6-month-old daughter. Just had my garden done, driveway done, and grass re-lawn. So very boring things.
Sounds expensive, mate.
It is, yeah. So it'll not be any more expensive purchases for a while. But yeah, apart from that, that's kind of the most exciting. I suppose, to be fair, the most exciting thing that's happened to me in the last 6 months is obviously becoming a father. So that's probably the big life change for me.
Big life change. Plus, you're living in Kent now. We were debating off air. Where is it? Beckley Heath? Is it London?
Yes. Is it London? Is it Kent? And definitely, I would say, given that I'm a... 7-minute drive from a tube station, Abbey Road, I'd definitely call that London. But to be fair, I don't really care either whether it's Kent. I'm not from around here. I just live here now. We moved here for childcare reasons. So moved from Teddington, Strawberry Hill, Twickenham area, which I was there for 16 years, which we mentioned. So Jesus. It was a big change.
Mate, are you missing it? Are you missing Teddington?
I miss Bushy Park. I do miss Bushy Park. And I miss the lifestyle that I had then, even though I wouldn't change what I've got now, being a father and things like that. I wouldn't swap it, but there's an element of me which does miss that lifestyle I had, where all my friends were living in the area still as well. Everyone's kind of moved out now, but you know, it was a time in my life where I'd retired from running, still had sort of 7, 8, 9, 10 of your friends in the area, and you put a text in the group on a Friday in the summer and be like, "Does anyone fancy going for some skewers at the pub, watching football or whatever?" Yeah. And you get everybody turning up. So it was, I think I'm mourning, not mourning, that's the wrong word. Yeah, I miss what I have.
Your wife's not going to listen, I don't think. So you're all good.
Yeah, she watched. She's in the next room, but she agrees. She feels the same, so it's fine.
Mate, brilliant. Look, some people might not know. I mean, I hope a lot of people know who you are, but let's just brief them on your career, who you are. 334, 1500 meter man. And you almost had, like a 10-year career in 3 months, I feel.
That's
2012 season was just mega for you.
It was almost a bit like... This wasn't my intention, but it was a bit like Jay from The Inbetweeners when it's like running completed it. Even though, I'll be honest, you know, you see Jake Whiteman and Josh Kerr winning world championships, making the semi-final of the Olympics is not completing it. But it was obviously the most I could get out myself, and I did it in a short space of time, as you mentioned. But I mean, it's funny, you know, you rightly so, you would point out the Olympics as being what people might know me for in that 2012 year. But obviously I was involved in running from, and I was actually, when you asked me to come on the podcast, I don't really get an opportunity to talk about running much these days, because I'm a has-been and nobody's particularly interested in speaking to you about it. But obviously it kind of got the cogs turning in my mind about, you know, you naturally start to think about your career and what you're doing, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, you know, a lot of my career was obviously before that as well, you know, as a junior English schools champion. And sometimes I might feel hard done by because I had to retire early and injuries and blah, blah, blah. But actually, forget about all the joy and the success that I had, albeit at a junior level and as a teenager. But it was still very rewarding and very fun. And it kind of reiterated to me when I was thinking about it, God, yeah, actually, even though my senior career wasn't as good as I wanted it to be, I still had a hell of a lot of fun and had some amazing experiences from the age of, like, you know, 14, 15, all the way up.
Mate, you had an extremely rich career. Because, yeah, I remember. Did you used to race James Shane?
I did race James Shane.
He was
a beast. James Shane's one of those ones as well. So, you know, I sort of exchanged a few messages with James Shane over the years when he retired, some on Facebook and things. But he was a beast, James Shane, and he was definitely someone who, you know, I feel like myself and James Shane were of a similar level of ability and talent, and he certainly could have done better than 3:36. And he only, I think he had that 2011 year where he kind of really kicked on, but James Shane was definitely a huge talent. Mm. And for him, again, injuries just wasn't, it didn't allow him to do what he wanted to do, but James Shane could have been a 3:31 runner, no doubt.
Yeah, I remember watching him at 2011 British Champs. But did your talent come at a cost?
That's a good question. It did, because I think in some respects, my physiology allowed me to do more than what my body was probably capable of most times. So you're always kind of able to run quicker in sessions or do things that your body probably wasn't quite strong enough to do. Yeah. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why my Achilles never quite held up in the way that it should. Of course, you know, on reflection, there's a lot more I probably could have done in terms of S&C, but it was very different times back then. Yeah. You know, when you're 17, 18, 19, everyone around you was sort of like, oh, S&C, whatever, we just run. Do you know what I mean?
That was the narrative, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was, yeah. It wasn't really, it wasn't kind of within the sport and the trend groups culturally the norm to be like, well, no, of course you need to do, you know, 30 minutes of prehab or S&C or whatever it might be a day. So it was a very different time, and the sport's got so much better. And, you know, I don't think anyone can argue that, you know, the spikes in the shoes have enabled people to run quicker, not just from a performance perspective, but also like I think from an injury resilience perspective as well. The kind of you're not getting as hurt and your body can recover better. But the sport is so much more professional now. There's so many more professional groups. There's so much more information around there. So, you know, the reason that the bar's been raised so much higher is not just the spikes. It's everything around it that make it a much more professional environment for people to thrive in.
Yeah, let's put your 2012 performance into perspective. You talk about professional setups. What were you doing that year? What was your jump? What was your progression from 2011 or your PB before 2012? I just remember that. The BMC headlines. I was only young at the time, but I remember the BMC headlines, like some dudes run 3:36 at Solihull. I was like, oh, wherever you did it. I was like, what? Like, that doesn't happen.
So I went to university as a 3:43 runner. I had a stress fracture in my first year and my femur. So that kind of ruled out 2010.
Was that your first, that was your first big injury?
It was, yeah, because I wasn't really doing much in the run-up to uni. The coach that I had at the time, John Stevenson, was, you know, very cautious and had built me through very nicely and very sensibly because, you know, like say I made European junior teams as an under-17, I've done a lot of good things. So it was a very measured progression through the age groups. And then obviously I got to university, I was like, I need to do sort of 60 mile a week or something. I went in doing like 50 mile a week. So you're trying to do 60 or 70. And you know, you're living away from home. You're not eating as well as you should do because you're trying to cook for yourself as an 18-year-old. So naturally my body just broke. So that ruled that year out. And then to be fair, end of 2010, I had a good, I think I finished something like 19th at Liverpool as a 19-year-old, just missed out on the 23 teams. That was good. That was a step forward. Then that winter, I ran 7:58 indoors. I think I was, did I win the British Champs or was I second? I can't remember. I think I've been second. And then ran 7:58 a week later at the Birmingham indoor. So I was starting to show signs of somebody who was taking those jumps forward. And then that summer, I kind of got some illnesses and quite frankly, I lost my head a bit. And I think I was a bit disillusioned because I've had this really good winter and it was like another issue. And I was a bit like, oh, fucking hell, like this again kind of thing. And then I kind of took a step back mentally and I was like, do you know what it is? I'm just going to enjoy running. I'm just going to not put any pressure on it. And the goal was to get fit enough and run fast enough to get a scholarship to America the next year. Because I thought, right, well, I've had sort of two sort of stop-start years. Yeah. If I can run 3:40, I'll get a good scholarship. I'll go back when 3:40 was worth something more than what it is now. I'd get a good scholarship, and that would enable me another 2 years of being a full-time athlete. And then, you know, I was looking at going, I think it was probably going to Villanova under Marcus O'Sullivan was the coach for someone. So I was going to go there.
You'd had conversations like this. Down the line. This was quite far along.
This was even in like January and February of 2012. And then because I stepped back and I was doing everything at what I would call like 80% intensity, I wasn't pushing anything. I was just letting the fitness come to me. There was no real pressure on it. It was just the perfect way for me to kind of build fitness in the background. And then I got to sort of like February, March time. I was like, oh, fucking hell, I'm going pretty well here. And then I did a few sort of shortening up sessions. I was like, I think I'm in good shape. I think this is, I'm in PB shape already. This is really good. And then I went and I think I was doing probably like from, I really got in, so up until December 2011, I was probably doing like 50, 55 mile a week, interval session in the park, a hill session and some thresholds. And then I managed to up my mileage to like sort of 70 mile a week and got that consistent through sort of January, February, March. And then when I started hitting the quicker stuff, that's when it really started to come together. I had a good aerobic base and my body was healthy. I was doing everything in flats, which really helped as well. I just stayed well clear of spikes. Again, that helped me build that consistency. And then started doing these, quite frankly, quite mad sessions, really, just where I was absolutely flying. And then I went and ran 3:40 at Stretford in my first race out and won it. And I was thinking, tell you what, 3-second PB in your first race, I'm going well here. And then the mentality shifted. And I was thinking, well, I tell you what, the European qualifying terms, like 3:39 flat, tell you what, if I can run that this year and go to a European champs, that's brilliant. Like, that's huge. Like, I'll definitely do that. And then that's when I ran 3:36 at Stretford with like a 54 last lap or something. And I was like, ah, I'm going better than even what I thought I was going.
Yeah.
And then got into Henglo and ran 3:34, which was obviously an Olympic qualifying time. And then backed off a bit, did the trials. I sort of struggled going into the trials. I think I was a bit fatigued because I'd started early, you know, because the plan was to run quick, finish my season after the European champs, perhaps, which would have been sort of June time, and then get ready to go to America. So then I got through the trials and then I was like, I'm going to go back and do a month of base work. So didn't really, just did a little bit on the track once a week, but doing a lot more stuff in the park, a lot more thresholds, put my mileage back up. And then I think just from a physiological perspective, just topping up on that aerobic base just gave us a new lease of life. And then I went and ran 3:52 at the Emsley Car Mile, finished just behind Kiplagat and beat the likes of Nick Willis and Leo Manzano and the gap was in there. I think.
To put it into perspective, Manzano got a silver in the Olympics that year, and you'd beaten him at a Diamond League, what, 2 weeks before, 3 weeks before?
I think Manzano was in there, but Nick Willis was certainly in there, and Kiplagat was certainly in there. And honestly, after the back of that race, I was thinking, man, I get a medal at the Olympics here. Do you know what I mean? If you're beating Nick Willis, who had won Olympic medals and you know was always going to be good, and obviously the way that I ran it, I was just full of confidence and felt completely indestructible. And then went to the Olympics and had a good run in the heat. And then my heat was the hardest and the fastest. You know, I had to run 3:36 to qualify. And the other heats were like 3:40. So I was a bit more tired going into the semis. And I think that's where I got found out a little bit in that, you know, someone who's doing 70 mile a week, where a lot of these guys would be doing 100 mile a week, 110 mile a week through the winter, didn't quite have the endurance or the strength to back it up. But also as well, looking back, I let the race be run a little bit too slow. Maybe if I'd have gone from 700 out, because, you know, I wasn't the fastest over 400 meters.
So it's difficult because what you're alluding to, you were just a bit passive in that race, but you'd never been in a race like that before.
Exactly. And I think, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? And the sport's changed so much in the way the 1500 meter running is done now, in that, you know, you see the likes of Jakob or even, you know, Josh Kerr, whoever, Chariot, whoever it may be, who hit it hard from the gun and are able to do that. But it just wasn't really the thing that people did back then, but they've shown that it can be done. And I think realistically, you know, if I'd have ran it from 700 meters out and just upped that pace, because I didn't have the ability to run a 50-second last lap. But what I probably had the ability to do was to run a at 54 than at 53 or something like that. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Still made the semi-final, and I think actually a lot of the people who beat me in that semi-final have since been banned.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was an amazing experience. It was like, sometimes think of my career. To me, again, I'm fully aware I didn't win anything. I didn't necessarily do anything at that top level. But for me, you know, it was amazing. And my career was like a shooting star. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was bright, it was flash, it was quick, it was boof. Sort of there 1 minute and it was gone the next, and continued on for, you know, years after. 2014 was a shit show. 2013 was a shit show. 2014 was a shit show. 2015, I actually had a decent year and had some good performances and was running some races where, you know, I won Watford in 3:37. You know, if you win in Watford in 3:37, you can absolutely get in one of those fast races and run 3:34 again. I don't think I was in any worse shape in 2015 than I was in 2012. I just didn't get the opportunity to run the races. I did the Emsley Corn Mile that year and ran 3:55 with a 54 last lap. And I think in that race was, you know, a fraction of a second behind Charlie Grice, who made the world champs final that year, Centrovitz. You know, I was there or thereabouts in 2025, but the stars didn't quite align for me that year. But realistically, I could have gone to the world champs that year, and then I probably wouldn't have made it out of the semi-finals again, to be fair. But it would have been nice to have gone to at least two major champs to, I would have retired happy, but I think if I'd have done that, I would have said, oh, I could have gone to the Europeans as well, I would have been happy. But,
yeah, interesting. I mean, how did, you talk about those years after 2012, how did that change your life? I mean, was the 8-year Nike contract, is that true?
No, that wasn't true for me. I know
just
that
a vicious
was true
rumor.
I know that was true for some American athletes, but I was a Nike athlete for 10 years or something like that, and it was they are brutal, these contracts, and part of me thinks they should be illegal, but you know, I was a victim of the 25%, 50% cuts because I didn't make a team again. And I think that's wrong. You know, I think if you're a brand and if you're saying to someone, we're giving you a 4-year contract because we believe in you, believe what you can do, then they should back you for 4 years. I don't actually think it makes, you know, they cut my contract by 10 grand, right? Which to them was, tonight is probably nothing. But to me, that's the difference of not being able to get physio, not being able to fuel yourself properly. Because I wasn't on funding, stressing about your rent. And you kind of think, well, you know, if you're investing in somebody, you've obviously given me a contract, so you believe I can be good. So why not just see it through for an extra 10 or 15 grand and you'll probably get a lot more out of me. But obviously, I don't know what it's like now, but that obviously wasn't the model back then. I think there's a lot more money nowadays, but yeah.
Yeah. Still though. So did you sign after 2012 then? You signed on the dotted line?
I was on a contract. So for those that don't, do you like to talk about contracts and things like that? Is it interesting?
We would love to. We've never got into it in enough detail because, like you said, we speak to people who are still involved in the sport and there's a lot on the line for them. But
well, I'm not in the sport anymore. Well, like I coach, I do some online coaching for Run Through and dip my toes in from a few little events. But so I was on a contract which ended in 2012, but it had what you call as an option year in that, right? So what an option year in your contract means is that they can keep you on for the same money if they choose to exercise it. Now, I signed this when I was like 18, 19. What the hell does an 18, 19-year-old know about contracts and things like that? Nothing. So I had made, I think the details might be a little bit sketchy, but it was something like this. So I'd ran under 3:36. So I think that was like a 10,000 pound bonus or something. So I wasn't on any money from Nike at the time. I was just on kit. So that was like a 10,000 pound bonus. And then I was on, I think making the Olympics was something in British champs. So it kind of totaled up to maybe it's like close to like 20 grand or something like that. So in a sense, they were like, well, we'll take your option year on and we'll pay 20 grand a year or something like that.
Yeah.
But I know there were other brands apparently who, you know, probably would have been willing to pay me 40 grand or something. So, but because I was tied, and by the way, you know, this is not me saying anything bad about Nike at all. I was with them for 10 years.
Mm.
You know, it is what it is. So there's no resentment or anything like that. But because I was on kind of an option year, I was stuck with Nike in some senses. I couldn't get out of it. But if I'd have been a free agent, then the likes of, to be fair, it was only New Balance and Nike that were offering contracts at the time. It's not like now where you've got Arne and Brooks and, Hoka and all that. But I probably could have earned more money had I been a free agent. And that's what it came down to a lot of the time, you know, with contracts. And you, to get a good contract, your contract had to be up that year and you had to have had a good year as well. So I'd had a good year, but my contract wasn't up, so I was a little bit pigeonholed. But still, do you know what it is? I'm not complaining, because it's still that plus funding enabled me to live as a full-time athlete for 2 or 3 years, something which most people don't get to do, and it was better than going and working in an office or something. So,
Mate, timing's everything, isn't it?
It really is, yeah.
Timing's everything when it comes to those finances. So you got on funding after 2012 though as well, because one of my questions is going to be, what was your relationship like? You speak about Nike there. What was it like with British Athletics at the time?
I think they tolerated me, to be honest with you. I was, interestingly, so I wasn't on funding or anything in the run-up to the Olympics, and hadn't been for like 2 years, I think.
Yep.
But obviously, when I made the Olympics, they're like, okay, well, we'll support you in terms of giving you access to physio and everything like that. And then as soon as the Olympics finished, they were like, right, well, you're not on funding, so we're not giving you any support. So in the August, I'm like, my Achilles is quite sore. Can we get some treatment on it? They're like, no, you're not on funding. The Olympics is over now. Off you pop. And I'm like, this is how it is. But they had to, I think they had to put me on funding because I'd hit certain criteria.
Yeah.
But I always got the sense, and people who worked there at the time, I don't think any of them are there now, but I always got the sense that, like, they had me on funding, but they probably didn't really believe in me as an athlete. And I kind of, they funded me and supported me to a point that they actually had to. Like, they were ticking a box. Okay, you know, it was box ticking for them. And then I was off funding not long after. But, you know, Barry Fudge was always really good to me after that and supported me when he could. And you know, I do get it, because let's say, I think I got kicked off after 2013. So I got 1 year of being injured, and they're like, see you later, which is a little bit frustrating.
Yeah, but I don't know if they can do that anymore, can they? I don't know if that's changed.
No, but anyway. Idea. But you know, credit to Barry Fudge. He was always, you know, as supportive as he could have been when it came to things like camps, trying to fund me where possible on camps. Wow. But aside from that, that was pretty much it. But, you know, I don't hold any ill feeling towards them or anyone who was involved in it at the time. But you know, I've seen other people who are in a similar situation who they seem like they really went the extra mile to support them. And they might sit there and they might have reasons, and there might be very valid reasons for not wanting to support me in the way they supported other people. But that's probably how I would feel about how I was supported.
Yeah, I feel like it's different now, because I feel like there is a bit more money in the sport, and there's more brands who are, you know, willing to support athletes. But it felt like, definitely from sort of 2010 to COVID, it felt like funding was everything. And a lot of athletes were falling into the trap of trying to tick the boxes to get on funding rather than just trying to perform. And did you ever feel like that? You know, when you got dropped again, was it like, oh, like, what do I need to do to get back on this? Like, did you feel like it was the be all and the end all to be on funding?
I suppose yes and no. Yes, because the support when you were fully on it was really good.
Right.
So it was a big thing. And like you say, the contracts aren't what they are now. Because I understand it now, you know, and this is a brilliant thing. I'm so happy, genuinely so happy. I'm not one of these people who's bitter. Like, so happy for the athletes now that the money that I'm hearing, people are being paid. You don't need funding. You don't need it.
No,
you know,
don't.
There's some people on, like, you know, 70, 80, 90 grand a year, whatever it may be. You can afford to fund yourself. So it's probably not as much, it's not as important as it used to be, where contracts weren't as good back then. You know, it might have been 20, 30, 40 grand a year once you've paid your rent, trips and all these things. There's not much left over. So I don't think it was, I need to run well to get on funding. I think your primary motivation was to run well so you could make teams and have a successful career, and then knowing that funding would come off the back of it. But I think in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, I'm going to need to really go the extra mile, because the way that they had the funding, it was to do with like medal potential. That's when they started to bring this in. And it was like, well, if you're not medal potential, you're not going to get on. It's like, well, who decides what is medal potential, right? Yeah. Like, there was no, it wasn't necessary. It wasn't a, well, if you make a final and come 10th, then potentially you could get a medal. They would look at your age, they would look at your setup, all these other things, and it would be quite subjective variables that they would take into consideration. They would sit on a board and decide if this person's medal potential, and that's very, like I said, very subjective. What you might see in an athlete is not what I might see in an athlete. So, it did feel like it was quite subjective. And again, it had that kind of poster athlete who I think they wanted to back and believed would be the medal potentials for them.
Mm. What was your setup at the time? Let's talk about St. Mary's, because I feel like you were at St. Mary's peaked around that 2012.
Yeah,
it probably peaked for about 4 to 8 years, right? Maybe beyond that as well. But did you start that? Who was there? Who was there before your era? Because I know Farah was there, right? But
yeah, Mo was there, and I think he'd actually lived for Mo, so yeah, he was there for a bit. I'd been going to St. Mary's as part of the London Marathon Junior Camps.
Yeah.
So it was always a special place to me because I loved going down there. I loved the area. I loved Bushy Park. And then Craig Winrell was the person that really drew me to the centre. So I wanted to go to get coached off Craig. At the time, you had people like Mitch Goose and Ben Lindsay and Andy, who were being coached by Mick Woods. You had Andy Vernon, who was there, who was being coached by Nick Anderson, but out of St. Mary's. And then in Craig's group, you had Andrew Asagi, who I think had been to the European under-23s, but wasn't quite making senior teams yet. James Brewer had done a bit of a stint there and made the World Champs semi-final in Berlin. So there was sort of, you know, murmurings of people doing well and it being a good setup. And then I joined, and then Andrew ran really well in 2010, I think. Did he go to the Europeans? I'm not quite sure. But Andy Padley was training out there as well. So there was lots of people in and around the area. And obviously we knew the Aussies used to go there and the Kenyans used to go there. Although I wouldn't necessarily base Kenyan success as a motivator to train somewhere anymore, knowing what we know now about Kenyan athletes. But at the time, we weren't aware. So there was a lot of good people there. It felt like a good environment to be in to thrive. Right. And then, I mean, it wasn't just me, but I think you're right. I think the success that myself, Colin McCourt, Andrew Sargi, Andy Verlin, that we had in that 2010 to 12 era, then sent so many different athletes like your Charlie Grice, you know, Amir Caress. Like, it was a snowball effect. So I would be. It wasn't just me, but I think definitely the success that Craig's group had, that Andy Vernon had, and of course Mo as well, but Mo had sort of gone off to train elsewhere at that point. But I think from getting the mass amount of students there and getting, you know, some of the highest quality school kids to start to go there, I would probably say that, yeah, it would be fair to say that, you know, that cohort of athletes that I was training with was a primary driver for that.
Mm-hmm. And what was your training like at the time then? In that St. Mary's setup, you've mentioned a few times about, you know, the professional setup, the S&C, like, how were you training? What was the environment like down there? Who were you training with?
Yeah, I think the first 2 years, so 2009/10 and 2010/11 of those academic years, I was hit and miss, if I'm honest. I was like, when I was training and things were going well, like when I mentioned about, nearly making the under-23 team for Liverpool as a first year under-23, that 7:58 indoors. When I had those little snippets of success and got some momentum, things were going well, I was sort of really dedicated. But then, if I'm honest, when things were going bad, I threw my toys out the pram and kind of probably a fairly immature response to it, where I'd just go and get pissed, which, you know, as an 18, 19 year old, I think at the time my attitude was, oh, fuck this. If I can't train, I'm going to go and have fun. And, you know, it is what it is. And me with my head now as a 35 year old, I wouldn't do the same. But as an 18, 19 year old, you're very different, aren't you? You know, like I say, I was more immature and probably didn't respond to it in the best way, but that's the way I did respond. But then that 2012 year sort of reined it in a little bit. So reined in the student drinking and partying. And to be fair, from the January onwards, was very dedicated. Wasn't really going out, was training with good people. And a typical week would probably look like like say 60 to 70 miles a week, with a bushy session, an interval session, a track session, and some threshold. And obviously that changed throughout the year depending on what was coming up, but that was a kind of the main framework. I didn't do any S&C, didn't do any of that. So it was really basic. And I think that's probably one of the things, I think, why I achieved what I achieved, but I think I could have gone here because I did what I did off pretty basic stuff, like 70 mile a week of, you know, what could you do if you're doing 100 mile a week? You know what I mean? Yeah. It's a big jump and, like say, not doing any S&C. So it was, and I used to work off a hard week, medium, I was 18 days hard. What I found was really good for me was doing 18 days hard where you'd sort of net out an average of a 70 mile week and then 3 days pretty much off and have a day off, a 4 mile run and a 6 mile run. So it allowed my body to recover and that that really helped keep the injuries at bay. So right. having within a 3 week period, having then 3 days really easy. So, you know, I'd have take Friday off to 4 mile on Saturdays, 6 mile on Sunday, and then start an 18 day cycle again. That was like the sweet spot for me, which did work really well. So that was basically it. It wasn't rocket science, you know, it was just consistency, getting the training in, not overdoing it, and not killing yourself.
What is the professional lifestyle for you? Like, were you happy when you were a professional?
That's a great question. I was happy when I wasn't injured.
Yeah.
I thrived in it when things were going well. I was very happy, but if I'm honest, the injuries and the inconsistency, found it very stressful, you know. You would see your peers running really well across the indoors, and meanwhile you've got a soleus tear and you haven't really trained and you know you're playing catch up. And I think with a more mature head on it now, if I could speak to myself, or if you clicked your fingers now when it was the start of 2013 again, I'd be able to approach it so much more differently. And have a much better perspective on it and think, well, you know, you've been injured through the winter of 2013, but that's okay. Just build up, just get fit. You can do something at the end of September, end of August, September, rather than going, I need to get fit for May, June to try and make a team. And actually you end up just shooting yourself in the foot because you get injured because you've tried to claw your fitness back. You've tried to push things too hard. And it was like a negative cycle of you're getting injured, you're less fit. You come back, you try and chase fitness, right? You get injured again, you're going down. And it's like you take one step forward and going two steps back. And it was only in 2015 when I started to kind of build that consistency back that I managed to break the cycle a bit.
Do you wish you ever took yourself out of that setup then? Like, because there was a lot of, it sounds like there was a lot of repeated mistakes. Mistakes is probably a strong word, but
no,
do you ever wish you tried something else? Different setup, different coach, different place.
Yeah, I mean, I did switch things up, and I moved at the end of 2015. I left Craig Winrow and I moved to Steve Crabb. Got a huge amount of respect for Steve, great coach, all the rest of things, but it probably didn't work quite well for me. Now, that's not to say it's not a good training setup and it's not good training, because he's had huge success with Norrin Wakeman, of course.
Yeah.
But for me personally, I didn't quite respond to the training in the way that I did with Craig. So the first thing I'd probably say is I probably wish I'd have just, at the end of 2015, had I just stuck with Craig and done more of what I was already doing and probably, you know, done what I'd done, but 10% more. And I think would have had a lot more success. If at the end of 2012, knowing what I know now, and if I couldn't have changed it, if someone said, do you want to go and get coached? If one of the, you know, Mark Rowland's Oregon Track Club or whatever one he was, then because my career didn't go the way I wanted it to, then yes, I would say I would have done things differently. But at the time, it probably wasn't right.
And you'd had success. That would have been a tough decision to make.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you'd be amazed at how quickly the years pass you by. Yeah, you kind of go, oh, well, 2013 was shit, but that's okay. Everybody has bad years. We'll go 2014, you go 2014, oh, that wasn't quite that game, but you know, we'll get there. We showed some glimmers of, you know, fitness. 2015, oh, it went well, but I think I need to change, and that was probably a big mistake. So
yeah. What was it about Cram's training that you didn't respond to?
I think it was so I used to work really well off three hard days a week, your intervals, your thresholds, or two interval sessions in the threshold, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday, right? That's what I worked well. And then very easy running around it. So my running around that when I was running well was probably like I never even used to wear a Garmin, but it was probably like between 7 minute miles and 7:30 miles. So really easy running. And that I think worked really well for me. Whereas Steve's training was more so your runs in between were a lot harder. And I was running something getting down to 5:40 miles on my days outside of sessions. Now, what I will say is that going into the 2016 season, I was flying. I was running really, really well. I think I did a session at Jarrow track, Steve's home track. and we did 12 threes in flats off a 45-second 100-meter jog, right? So you like 300, 45 seconds. It's quite quick to get run, right? That's like...
That's a very tough recovery, depending on what pace you're doing these threes.
Six-minute mile pace, 90 seconds left, something like that. Yeah. So, and it was sleeting, so the track was wet. I was on my own, it was a bit windy, and I started at, like, say, 44s, 43s, and finished down at 42s, right? That was like, all right, I'm in 3:37 shape already here, at least. Do you know what I mean? I was going really well. But because I was running so hard in between sessions, I was very light. I was very lean. I kind of was, you know, in the Olympic year, I was 67, 68 kilograms. And I think I was down to like 64, 63. Mm. And then it was just that bit too much. And then I got sort of like septic tonsillitis, and that really knocked me back. And then I had a calf strain. So it wasn't a case. It was just that bit too intense for me, for someone who was probably a bit fragile in terms of robustness. It was just a bit too hard for me. But like I say, that's not saying it's bad training. It worked for Laura.
Yeah.
She had a great career. It just, for me, it didn't quite work.
Yeah, I feel like just on that as well, it's quite a difficult era for you guys. So I know you had Andy Baddeley who was doing great things. And like you mentioned, James Brewer and stuff, a couple others who were sort of there or thereabouts. But we didn't have at that time the Jake Wymans, the Josh Kerr. So you guys were trying to buck the trend. You were trying to break through. And you know, you obviously had these guys like Cram who were knocking around and obviously coaching and stuff like that. But they were in a very different era, and what worked for them but obviously didn't work for you. And I feel like now when we're coming through, it's like, okay, well, we can see what Kerr are doing. We can see what Jake's doing. And those youngsters are going to have a pretty clear pathway of how to get to the top. You would like to think once Jake and Kerr are retired there, they'll share their sort of expertise. But That was probably quite challenging, wasn't it? Having to be the first one. There was so many of you on the cusp, but...
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why we're seeing people run so much faster as well is that sharing of knowledge. So there's so much more information around there about how people are training. Whereas, like you say, you didn't really know what anyone was doing. Social media wasn't necessarily... there, but it wasn't really being utilized in a way to share knowledge around training. So you were largely in the unknown. And I think if I can give any advice to anyone, really, is if you find a system or a style of training that works for you, do that, but just a little bit more each year. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater kind of thing. And that's, in some senses, what I did when I moved to Steve. Because, you know, in my defense, you know, I went from 2012 to 2015 and things hadn't quite improved. I hadn't improved at all. So I was thinking, well, yeah, I've got to try something else. I'm 25 now. So, you know, like I said before, hindsight's a wonderful thing, and it's easy to say what you would have done differently, know what preceded your decision making. But if you found a style and a system that works for you,
rinse and repeat.
Keep doing that, and keep doing, you know, rinse and repeat. Like, I think Jakob Ingebrigtsen's a really good example of that.
So many. I mean, I spoke with Noureddin Morceli once, and I sort of was asking him.
Name drop.
Yeah. Bannister Miles a few years back. And I remember picking his brains, and I was just like, so what is he doing? He said we would do the same thing every year. We would do our base training in Florida. At home, and then he would go to Florida just before indoors, and then he would go up to altitude just for outdoors, and it was exactly the same. Same weekly mileage on X given week, and it was rinse and repeat. So and once his body was used to it.
Alan Webb said that as well. You know, Alan Webb, for those who maybe a little bit younger and don't know Alan Webb, he ran a 3:46 mile at a random track in Belgium in 20...
The weirdest race ever.
Yeah. 2007, and he ran 1:43. He was great. He was like a high school prodigy and all this kind of thing. And he said what I would have done differently after that year. He said, I would have just done the same as what I'd done the year before, but 2% more. I was running a 3:46 mile. I didn't need to be any fitter. I just needed to do the same again. And in a sense, that was like maybe 2012. You know, I was 21. I'd had 6 months of training. I was doing 70 mile a week. I'd run 3:34. If I'd have done another year of that, I probably would have run 3:33 and not been injured. But like you say, even going to 75 mile a week, that's, you know, just under a 10% increase, 10% more. You're doing a little bit more of S&C. All these little increments would have been a really good way to do it. But well, such is life.
We just want more, don't we? Everyone wants that breakthrough. Everyone wants
And it only comes from a good place because you want to be the best and you want, it's you know, it's not necessarily stupidity. It's just, you know, you want it and you want it to go well and you want to succeed.
I got to ask, you were competing a time with Farah in his absolute heyday, his prime. You would have been in the Olympic Village. I don't know, was he in the Olympic Village in 2012? Did you see him? What did you see of Farah in 2012? And what was he like in that era?
Well, I lived with Mo briefly in 2009 and 2010. When I first moved to St. Mary's. So, you know, got to know him a little bit. I'm not going to sit here and go, I was best friends with
him.
I wasn't at all. But I just got to know him. And then, obviously, I didn't do much and he was having all that success in 2010 at the Europeans in 2011. And when I was living with him, he was mostly away on like altitude camps and things like that. So I think he was training with Alan Story mostly at the time, so he was away. But of course, during 2012, I didn't see much of him. I was sharing an apartment with Andrew Sargi, Chris Tomlinson, I think. I can't really remember who was in there with. But I think Mo was, you know, I mean, imagine the pressure that he had on him. I think he was, you know, keeping himself to himself naturally, and rightly so. But on the circuit, he was always, you know, he was always really nice, to be honest with you. Yeah. You know, I think I remember it at the Birmingham Diamond League after, he was seeing him and he was like, oh, how are you getting to the stadium? Do you want to come in my car, his private car? so he did that. But yeah, he's you know, what you see of Mo on the TV, on like I'm a Celebrity or whatever he's on at the moment, is kind of how he is. He's a nice guy. He's a chill guy. And like I say, I mean, I couldn't imagine what that pressure was like, having, you know, the whole nation expecting you to deliver when it's, you know, the biggest, other than the World Cup final in 1966, it's probably the biggest sporting event in the UK. But I mean, I'd argue it probably is the Olympics in London. So yeah, I imagine he was just doing whatever he could to block out all of the noise, to block out the pressure, and stay away from people, to be honest. I think he spent a lot of time with Chris Thompson, actually. I think that's who
did
he?
Did used to race. When did you come to terms with the fact that your career might be done then? Was that a tough decision?
I don't think I have. I anticipated this question. Obviously, this week I was sort of thinking about it. And, all right, so from like, at the end of 2016, like you say, I was running really well with Steve, and then it all was disastrous after that. Yeah. And then through 2016, 2017, I said I was going to move up to the 5K because I couldn't quite tolerate the quick stuff. And that just didn't really go well. I was starting to get big problems with my heels. So I had a Haglund's deformity. Oh. And then I went and seen a surgeon and he was like, you're going to need to get this. So this was in end of 2017. He said, you're going to need to get this reconstruction. You'll need to take Achilles off. It'll be like a year pretty much out to recover. And I was thinking, well, that rules out 2017 till the start of 2018, and then 6 months of that, so that's 2018 out. So 2019, and I was just thinking, and then he said, you might need the other one done, and there's no guarantees that it's going to work. And I was sort of wasn't being paid anymore to run, and I just thought, I'm just going to quit when I'm ahead. I'm not going to long this now. I'm not going to dip into savings. You know, I've made a little bit of money through running, and I thought, well, at least I can retire saying I've been to the Olympics, I had a great junior career. There's been other little snippets of gun running in there, and I can retire not being broke. And I had a job offer to go work with TripAdvisor, and I thought, well, actually, this, I'm going to quit when I'm ahead. So that was almost a forced decision where I said, right, well, you know, it's going to be 20 2018, probably 2019, at least before I can get back. And I'll be 28, and I just thought, I just don't think it's really worth it. But I had this other offer to go and start my professional career outside of running. But in terms of getting over it, you never really do, I don't think. I think when I started working at TripAdvisor, I had a great boss, Justin Reed, who was a runner as well. And I had the surgery on my heel, and I came back and I was running, and he was sort of like, look, you know, this was before working from home regularly was a thing.
Yeah.
He said, you know, if you want to work from home on a Tuesday and a Thursday, you can get your training done. Maybe you can try and find a way that you can run around the job. And I was like, okay, yeah, this could work. Who knows? Let's see what happens. It became clear that the surgery that I'd had done on my left foot just completely fucked me as a runner. Like,
oh, no.
I just could never get the run as quick as I used to, run the same. And if you look at my left calf, it's a lot smaller. The plantar on my foot was painful a lot because the whole heel had been repositioned. So my whole biomechanics had changed. And, you know, I did a spell of running where I was doing 60 mile a week, and the quickest I could get to was like a 15, 25K or something like that. Now, if I'd have done that previously, that would have been 14 minutes. So my whole biomechanics had changed. And people probably, if they'd have seen me train and run and going, bloody hell, he's done all this training, he's only around 15, 20, not knowing that the surgery had just, it was like, do you know when you see those superhero movies? This is what it felt like to me. Yeah. When you have those superhero movies where they lose their superpower, right? They get the superpower taken away from them. And my superpower was being very good at running and not being able, like, not having to do much training and being able to run very quick.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't do it anymore. It just wasn't the same. But unfortunately, unlike the movies, I didn't get my superpower back. So I think I kind of knew.
There's still time.
No, there's not. No, that ship. Interesting. I mean, that ship's completely sailed for me now. You know, again, when I started working at 28, 28, 30, I was thinking, yeah, well, you know, I'm still young enough. I might have another one last hurrah and have a little pop in it. But like I say, it became clear my body and my running wasn't ever going to be the same again. So I started to run purely for fun.
Yeah. What's your relationship? Yeah. Well, I was going to say, what's your relationship like with the sport now? But from a runner's standpoint, but also from a fan, like, are you engaged? Like, how much of the sport are you consuming? It's changed a lot since you were competing. And I wondered if, you know, how you view it and if you enjoy it.
Yeah. As a consumer, I went out to, I love the champs. So I always do tune into the champs. So I even went to the World Champs in Budapest to view as a spectator. Sweet. Yeah. Loved it. Also went to Munich for the European champs to go out. Paid my own money just because I love the sport. Obviously, you know, well engaged with the Olympics and things. But I wouldn't say I'm like a super fan now. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I don't sit down and watch the Diamond Leagues every weekend. Nah. I don't follow every single result. I try and keep an eye on people who I know of running, like, you know, if you know, I'm friends with Jake Whiteman, so if Jake's running, I'll deliberately tune in to watch Jake. You know, Adele Tracy, someone like that, people who I know, I'd always tune in to watch them. And it's not a case of I don't watch it because I'm bitter or it's just it's a timings thing as well, you know. There's other things going on in my life, and there's other things that I do. Like you say, becoming a father now as well, that takes up a hell of a lot of time, funnily enough. So I still love the sport. I still love watching the championships. I still watch the champs. But outside of that, I mean, I liked the British champs last summer as well, so I really enjoyed that. So when I get the time, I definitely will watch it and go up and engage. But I wouldn't say I, you know, follow it to the finest detail. And I'm not fully aware of all the athletes. Naturally, I like middle distance and long distance events. Yeah. I think I'd struggle to tell you who's the top 100 meter and 200 meter sprinter at the moment.
I mean, it's a political answer from you there, bud.
but I still love running. Last year I trained for Ealing Half Marathon and ran 76 minutes or something like that. It was a hilly course. So,
I mean, I've seen you've botched out a few marathons as well. You're 2:30.
No, not a marathon. No, just the half. So I did the half, and I was like, I don't think I could do a full marathon. Yeah. But I still, you know, again, that was like doing 35 mile a week.
I think someone's like got the same
looked
name
a
as
different,
you.
Looked at a different Ross Murray.
No, genuinely, because there's a Ross Murray on World Athletics. It's you, and it says you've done Dublin Marathon.
No, not me. Well, what's the PB? 231?
235.
Yeah, go on then. Why not? We'll see how to make it.
235, Ross. It's your profile in World Athletics. It's mad.
Yeah, well, I've been really pissed and turned up in Dublin.
That's a London qualifier right there. You've got championship entry right there, bud.
I would like to do a marathon at some point, but I enjoyed my running last year. Mm-hmm. But then when I became a farmer, I just didn't have the energy because I was up through the night.
Yeah.
But I'm at a point now, I do like 25 mile a week. I'll do a session and a threshold, 5K threshold in 17 and a half minutes. So just like a general fitness, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I would like to do, I'd like to do the Great North Run. And if I did that, I'd do a proper trainer block for it. I can't do it this year because I've got a wedding, but maybe next year I'll look to do Great North Run and then do a marathon before 40. You've got to try and do London, haven't you?
Mm. Well, yeah, you've got the standard, mate. So
exactly, I
want to talk about relationships with the sport because you were one of the first to ever do a running podcast, mate. Probably one of the first podcasts I listened to. That running podcast is bloody good as well. So people listen to this, I hope they go and listen to it, you and Colin McCourt. And well, one, like, why did you stop? And do you look back on that and think, crikey, if we just kept this thing going, where could you be? Because you could be doing that full time. Like it was very good.
Yeah, well, I loved doing it. Mm. It was really good fun. And I think I'd always enjoyed any kind of, although it was not a huge amount of opportunities, but enjoyed the kind of the broadcasting opportunities that I did do. Mm. I enjoyed chatting. I love running. So it seemed like a good thing to do. Do it with a mate, Colin McCourt. And I recognized there was nobody doing it really. And it was that time where podcasts were kind of really starting to ramp up and really enjoyed. We did two or three series of it and had some great guests, had some great conversations and had so much positive feedback from people. And it was lovely. And I don't really know why we stopped, to be honest with you. I think we were always going to come back and then we just never did. And then it was, but I do really regret not keeping that going because like you say, we had a great listening base and we got in the top sports podcast on Apple iTunes all week as well. Do you know what I mean? We were getting some really good momentum and I really enjoyed it. So yeah, I do regret stopping that actually. And at that time, because I was doing the podcast, I was still very much engrossed with the sport as well. Mm. So I was still very much involved in, because you have to, right? If you're going to host a podcast about running, you need to know what you're talking about. So really enjoyed it and do regret giving it up because it was good fun. I think as well, I'd started online coaching a bit more. I think it was, it was at a time where we were 5 days a week in the office. So
yeah.
For anyone who's into it, it was long days committing to London and back. You know, you're leaving the house at 7:30, you're not getting back till 7:00, then that's your week. And then you're trying to do some running of your own, trying to do some online coaching, you're trying to socialise and see friends. And I think I was just getting to a Sunday and I was like, I'm just zonked here, too tired. But now people work from home all the time, it'll be a piece of piss.
Well, yeah, literally. And I feel like it was at a time where the podcast was just taking off, but there wasn't this, well, it was like social media then as well. There wasn't influencers then. They were very popular accounts, but no one was an influencer. And I feel like COVID just completely changed that.
It did. Yeah, it was, you're right. There wasn't your Spencer Matthews and your other reality TV host doing podcasts about running or sports or whatever. There wasn't anything out there. I think there was, is it Brady Threatful in Australia? They did a podcast. What's their podcast called? Forget. Mate, so there's an Australian one. They had one, but I think there wasn't really. And there was Marathon Talk as well. There was Marathon Talk. But Marathon Talk was very as it says
for recreational runners.
Yeah, and talking about training and things like that. But what we really tried to do with that running podcast was more so allowing people to see the personal side of the athletes. Yeah. That's what we really like to do. We really like to try and bring the personality out in the guests that we had on. So it wasn't just talking about the running. We did cover that off, but it was, giving them an insight into who they are, what a character's like, what things they like, what things they don't. And we try to have a real laugh with it. And I think people enjoyed it. But didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also, I think because you were both out the game, you didn't have as much skin in the game, then you were both slipping into not recreational running, but and just listening to you guys talk about your running was always fun as well.
Yeah, because like you say, you're not beholden to anyone. We didn't have any sponsors.
Yeah.
We had nothing like that, so you could say what you wanted, really, which was always good.
Different era. But, mate, absolute pleasure to have you on today. So thanks for giving up your time on a Friday.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.